session number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, Reel 8. So you're telling me about how you won the remote control for manoeuvring the
I heard this very weak signal in front of us, just on a scrap of signal pad. We used just to have roughly drawn, I mean it wasn't sort of navigationally correct, roughly drawn a position of the ships. And a destroyer, we were steaming eastwards, and a destroyer on the coastal side of us, although we were way off the shore, at the rear of the screen, because it's a horseshoe shaped screen, I heard make a signal. Now, you can make flag signals by radio. I heard him make this, it's T for Tommy, what we call Link AT, which meant torpedo astern. A very, very weak signal, and I had just heard this torpedo astern. Now, there was strict WT silence in force by the commander in chief. This is when I disobeyed him. I had a microphone, I could talk to the operator down below, and I pushed the switch down, and I said to old Jacko, who was on the radio down below, I said, did you get that signal from such another destroyer? You see, can't remember the name of it now. He said, I never heard anything. And I thought to myself, well, I did definitely heard this torpedo astern. Nothing happened on the Warspite, which was the capital ship, so I switched on my transmitter. And with that, the leading hand, who's sitting in the chair, half nodding off, sat upright. What are you doing? What are you doing? He said, you see. And I haven't got time to talk to him. And I just, what we call, zedded it in. I sent the message I received from the destroyer to the commander-in-chief ship. So I immediately broke rules by breaking WG signs. I can imagine on board there, panic happening, and, you know, no one wanting to break silence on there and sort of reporting it. And I thought, to hell with this, that torpedo's coming for us. Yeah, from the position of the destroyer. And I remember my old training in Ganges, and you know, which way to turn with torpedoes. You know, if it's aft the beam, you turned away. If it's forward of the beam, you turned toward it. I got a voice pipe in front of me. I lifted the lid and I called down to the compass platform. Remote control office bridge, and the yeoman of signals on the bridge said, bridge. I said, from the commander in chief to all ships, blue 9 executive signal go, which is a signal for all ships turned to starboard, 90 degrees to starboard. Executive signal go to do it, you see. And I heard I could hear the yeoman say to the captain, captain, sir, from the commander in chief to all ships will turn 90 degrees to starboard, executive signal go. And the ship went hurtling around like this. And then I heard the captain's voice, because he was one of those captains who didn't need a speaker. We are the only bloody ship turning, he said. And the leading hand sat there in my watch. He's going, not doing me, not doing me. He said, just all you want. He's pointing to me like this, because I've done this, you see. And next thing, I got near the heavy footsteps coming up the ladder from the campus platform to the office, you see. And I thought, I've had it. Just then the door opened, and the captain said, who made that? And he said, and the leading hand said, he did, sir, he did, sir. And just as he'd said that, the gunner who directs from position up top reported torpedo passing down the starboard side. And the captain just put his hand on my shoulder. They said, well done. And went out. So that disobeyed a commander in chief and got away with it. Because I could see myself locked up. The exuberance of youth.
This took some nerve.
Yeah.
Anything else you remember from that period in the Mediterranean?
No, I'd say everything was sort of quite normal, because I mean the army operation was going well. We used to go into Mers El Kiba. I mean, we used to catch a bus round into Oran, go ashore in Oran. When we was in Algiers, because often we went into Algiers as well. I remember going in the Casbah in Algiers.
What was that like?
And as a youngster, and I think must have been my 19th birthday.
Could be my 19th.
That'd be
June 42.
Yeah. can't remember what John Delaney was though. Was it the following year?
Sounds a bit wrong, but yeah, I'm not sure.
I might have been 90. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We went in the cash bar and buy this cheap champagne, and we had no corkscrew, and I was absolutely mad, so we just knocked the head off the bottle and just drink out the jagged end, like, is it? And I remember there was me and Taffer, was another a chappy called Paul Wincup. I always remember Paul, quite a small though. And when you come back to the dockyard in Algiers, there's a road, and there's a drop of about 100 foot down, and it did flat, you know, where the harbour is and is. And we've been eating cherries and drinking champagne. And Paul wanted to be sick, and here Taffy grabbed hold of him, and we held him over this drop, 100 foot drop. So he could be. And some soldiers come up and grabbed us, said, "Come on, Jack, so steady, like, you're going to drop him, like, see if he's holding him so he can be sick." But nothing to do in Mersey or Key, there's nothing there, but I mean, we used to swim, you know, you could swim. There was a little, like a breakwater, which was formed the harbour, and there's a little hole through it, and just go out in the sea and swim. I always remember the American, that's the one time I saw Americans' logistics go wrong, because when we first went into Mersey or Key, there was lots of Americans on the breakwater, and they were begging for food. I've never known that with Americans. They always, and we were giving them rock cakes and bread and that sort of thing. Something had gone wrong with their supply, and they hadn't had any. They were a bit hungry, because normally they have steaks and ketchup, don't they, and everything, the Americans. But I can't remember sort of anything until happening, other than, you know, the odd, say, frog in the tax, but they got wise to that, and they used to sort of boats patrolling around, dropping little grenades over the side all the time. That's the usual procedure. I can't remember what stage this was, but one time we called into Gibraltar, and something had stayed in my mind ever since. We called in Gibraltar, and I think it was earlier than this period, but I can't remember exactly when. And this boat came out from the Spanish side with, I think there was about four men in it and one woman. And she started stripping off her clothes alongside the ship, just off the ship, and they were begging for bread. And this sticks in my mind, tears are rolling down her cheeks. It was obviously their sister. And because they just got over the Spanish Civil War. Because this is early on, it was before this time, but it's something that sticks in my mind. And obviously a decent girl and that sort of thing, and been detailed off to do this. And I thought, you know, this is one of the tragedies of war you don't think about. They were hungry, and, you know, and sailors were throwing bread, giving it all away. But I remember seeing this girl standing there, tears rolling down, stripping off. Another time we was in Gibraltar. My brother at the time was in the Merchant Navy. My father was also in the Merchant Navy. And he was on the... He was on a troop ship, a big liner troop ship, and she was in the bay, but she was under quarantine. And I asked if I could go and see my brother, and they gave me permission, and they sent me out in one of the ship's boats, but I had to stay in the water and talk to him. Sort of from, you know, he was on the deck because they were under quarantine. There was some malaria or something on there. I don't know what it was. But that's one thing that stuck in my mind. That poor girl stripping off, it just stuck in my mind.
Now, what's the next thing you remember after this then? What happens next?
I can't. We went to after the North African day.
When did you leave the Formidable?
In 30th of November 1943, by which time I was a leading telegraphist. I'd worked my way up from a boy tell to a leading telegraphist by this time. I'm trying to think.
Did you stay in the Med or? You weren't involved in the operations around invasion of Sicily.
Oh yeah, that's right. Of course we were. That's right. We was we He was in the Anzio. That's when the war spike got the break. That's right.
What about before that at Sicily? Were you off there? Or,
I mean, we were still out there, but I don't think involved in any way with Sicily as such. We were just out there sort of patrolling, but I can't remember the Anzio or Salerno we were involved in now. Which one? I know at that time the Germans had these radio controlled bombs, and they used to drop them, and I mean they weren't flying bombs, and like they used to drop them, but by radio they could sort of change their path as they were dropping down, so they sort of, and this was became a bit of a chaotic situation, because at this time I was leading hand of a watch in the remote control office, and what they did is, because all your transmitters are tuned up to different frequencies that you might be going to use all the time, you know, the different way. Those that weren't were tuned up on other frequencies. And every ship in the fleet, as soon as there was an air attack, you switched on all your transmitters. And if they were on Morse, you just pressed the key, and you had chaps at action stations just varying the frequency slightly back and forth, pressing the key. Or if there was a mic, you shouted in the mic. Because they didn't know what frequency these bombs operated on. In hopes that the whole fleet would be covering a whole wide band of the frequency spectrum and muck up their sort of targeting. And I remember being leading down the watch in the remote control office, and I had a... No. Yes, that's right. And... sent the coder down to the galley to get some cocoa, and we had an air attack while he was gone. And I remember switching on all the transmitters, and I had one leg along the bench, knocking three Morse keys, and the head oscillating back and forth, shouting in three microphones. It was like a madhouse sort of thing. I can't remember if it was Anzio or Salerno. I'm pretty sure it was Salerno. Because I remember going up...
That would be September 43.
Would it? Yeah. Because I
think Anzio's later, so I don't think it's...
Yeah, yeah, I think it was Salerno. Because the war spike got hit by one of these bombs, and she never... the only other thing she did after that was to go off the coast at D-Day and act as a stationary, you know, sort of gun platform. But I remember seeing the most terrific barrage I've ever seen from the ships, because going up on deck once when they put this barrage up, and all you could see all along, as far as you could see, was shell bursts, you know, the sort of Oligans, pom-poms, 4-5 shells, anything else, sort of from the sea level up to sort of 200 or 300 feet. You know, the aircraft were still coming through it. It was absolutely amazing. And then after that, we went back.
Now, tell me about your promotion. I mean, how was it actually managed? I mean, did you have to take the exams first, or yeah. How was it done?
Well, to ordinary telegraphist, you got made an ordinary telegraphist when you're 18. Now, if you took, if you had taken what they called an exam called ET2, which was like an advanced exam, which I did. When I think that was a boys' training ship, I did ET1 and ET2 there. You got made an ordinary telegraphist at 17 and a half. I took the exam for telegraphist on board the ship, because they had senior people that could take it. I took the exam for what they called trained operator, because in those days they had telegraphist, then what they called trained operator. He had a star above his badge. But to take the leading tells exam, I had to go aboard, either go to a signal school or a commander in chief ship. And what I did, none of the PO or the chief on board could tell me what the syllabus consisted, because they'd all been away at sea in the war, and nobody knew exactly what the exam consisted of. So what I did, I requested that when we went into gym, one of these times we went into gym, I went aboard the Nelson battleship to take you could, because during the war, you could take leading telegraphers lower than leading telegraphers higher, but you had to do a course to do higher, like in the signal school. So what I did, said I would like to go aboard, not thinking for one moment I'd pass the exam, but at least I'd know what was required. So this I did, I went aboard the Nelson, took the exam, and failed it. But then I knew exactly what the syllabus was, what I'd do. And later on, I took the exam again, passed it. One thing that happened in Gibraltar...
What difference did it make when you were promoted to leading seaman? I mean, to your life?
Leading telegraphist.
Leading to, sorry, yeah.
I mean, to start with, as a junior leading telegraphist, I was like a senior operator of the watch. I wasn't in charge of what. But then I got promoted. There was a much more senior leading telegraphist than me, but the chief didn't think much of him and his job. And I got promoted in his place. And he was quite senior to me in age and experience, but he wasn't sort of really up to it, and I took his job as leading hand of the watch.
Did you like the responsibility?
Oh yeah. One of the things that happened when we were in Jib, I was sitting there, all the radio receivers around the, not the, so we take a square radio office, all around the base, all around the side. Just off there was an annex where they had the power amplifiers for the sound reproduction equipment, which gave the entertainment to the ship's crew, where they could play records and relay radio and that sort of thing. Also the amplifiers for the ship's downhaled within the ship. The leading hand and the coder sat in, and the signalman or the message handler sat on a big desk in the middle. And I was sat there. A lot of people were sure, there was sure leave given, but we were on watch. And one of my operators, that was old Pandarard, if he was right in the signal, and he kept going, and I thought, what's that mad bugger doing? Because, blokes should have a bit of a joke at times, that sort of thing. And he kept going. So I walked over to see what was up, looked over his shoulder, and he went, and the whole office in there was aflame. Because the amplifiers have been going non-stop without any break or services and that sort of, because they've been used all the time, they're absolutely massive flame in there. So I said to the signalman, call out, the damage control people, sort of fire and emergency parties and whatever, that sort of thing. Because being a communicator, my job was to maintain communications. So in the transmitting rooms down aft, you also had receiver and receiving bay in each. So I got one of the chaps in the office, I said, go down to number one TR, man such as frequency. As soon as you're on, let me know. Send another one down to the other one, man the other one. So I said, as soon as you're on, let me know. Once they'd done that, I said, the two chappies that were on watch here, right, out you get. Well, the damage control party, the fire party, was stood outside, wouldn't come in the office. I dashed in there on my own with a fire extinguisher and finally managed to put out the fire. But I mean, because it was acrid, the transformers, all the pitch and that sort of thing, the room was full of smoke. My lungs were absolutely burning. The reason these boys outside hadn't come in, they knew a bit more than I did. And the deck below us was the ammunition locker, and the deck above us was the petrol. So, in my ignorance, I was in there fighting. And I always remember, I sent the chappie afterwards, sent the chappie for a big fanny full of cocoa, and I nearly drunk this, about a gallon of cocoa in one go, because I was absolutely burning down, even though the cocoa was hot. And I always remember the petty officer, Ben Pescott, who, apart from, he used to, I mean, they didn't have petty officers watchkeeping in Arbor, but the lead man was in charge of us, but... he was responsible for the maintenance of his room, and he was giving me a rollicking, for being so late and getting in there to put the fire out. And the chief turned around and said, he's a communicator. His job was to maintain communications, which is what he did, and patted me on the back sort of thing for it. But poor old Ben was dead sad, even in tears, to see all his gear burnt up.
And that room was called the...
Well, it was like an annex just off the main wireless. And as I say, there was the amplifiers in there for the the speaker system throughout the ship, where they, the quartermaster pipes on there, or the captain speaks to the ship's company, and there's microphones all over the ship. And of course, they've been on 24 hours a day, day and night, you see. Also in there was a radio receiver, amplifier, and record turntable for entertaining the crews and that sort of thing.
So anything else happened?
No, after Salerno and all that, we went back to Belfast, where we started, and we paid off the ship 30th of November 1943.
And how did you feel to be leaving? I mean, this ship had been your home for three years.
A good ship. I mean, I advanced from a boy to a leading telegraphist and that sort of thing, and all my mates have been there as well. One of the things about the early stage in the Med, which didn't affect me, but a lot of people don't know, because things weren't going well with the Army ashore in the Med in those days, was about a large proportion of the people ashore were sailors who hadn't been trained to fight ashore. Because the rules at that time in the Eastern Med was that you couldn't go home on leave unless you'd been a survivor three times. In other words, you'd been sunk three times. So what used to happen, when a chap had been sunk once or twice, they used to put him in khaki and send him ashore with the army so he couldn't be sunk a third time. Because I remember a very good friend of mine, who was a friend right through my naval career, I was always bumping into him, a chap called Reg Hickey. He went ashore with the army. And I mean, all they had was a 303 rifle. And because later on you hear all the glory about Montgomery, but he had all the weapons and all the troops. But the other poor generals was making do with, a mixed match of sort of people. Because, I mean, sailors weren't trained to fight ashore anyway. I mean, and I always remember when we were sailing from Alexandria to go to America for the last time, there was this chap who stood on the jetty, very smart-looking soldier, his BlackBerry, tank corps badge, khaki short shirt, his little miniature gaiters and that sort of thing, looking very bronzy. And I said to him, where are you going, mate? And he said, oh, formidable. And I said, we're sailing. This is the last boat back. He said, yeah. So I looked quite puzzled. I thought, a member from the tank corps. When he got aboard, he was a Royal Naval Signalman and been serving with the tanks. So there was quite a Fred Carno's army, really, in those days, in the early days.
Now, what happened when you paid off in November at Belfast? What happened to you? Where were you sailing?
We went back to Portsmouth Barracks. Because the signal school was then in Portsmouth Barracks. I don't believe HMS Mercury at Leydean came into force till about 44, but I think in Portsmouth Barracks it was known as KK Block, was the signal school.
Did you get leave in December 1st?
I was only there. I was only in the barracks about 10 days. I had 7 days stoppage of leave.
Now, what was that?
I lived in North Edmonton, North London at the time. I went home on weekend leave, and there was one of these thick pea super fogs, and a place where I'd been brought up in, knew all my life, and I thought that there was no trains running, nothing. I thought, but I'd get to the police station and get my leave pass stamped. And I even got lost getting to the police station in the town which I'd been brought up in all my life. And I got in the police station. And the police sergeant, I remember the police sergeant stood behind the desk there, and he said, there's no buses or trains, anything running, lad, he said. And he stamped my pass, unable to travel, no transport due to fog, and signed it. And I remember the stamp, it was Metropolitan Police Y Division. And I got back, instead of getting back at 7:30 on the Monday morning, I think I got back about 11:30, something like that. And reporting to the Master Arms Office, and he said, you're on a charge, absent without leave. I said, I've got a pass. I said, stamped by the Metropolitan Police Sergeant. I go up before the commander, off caps, did we remain absent from that league, namely from, you know, etc., etc., etc. And the commander looked at me and he said, you are a leading seaman. I was a leading telegrapher's man. He said, you are a leading seaman. You'll forecast the weather and come back 24 hours early. And I think he said, I can't remember, it's 5 days or 7 days pay. Anyway, I got so many days to pay and leave stuff. And Marshal Arm said, on cap, about turn. And I had to hand my card into him because he leaves stop. And as I walked out, he said, air captain, sideboard's off. And that was the only time I served ashore. And I thought, if this is the shore going Navy, they can keep it. Put me back to sea.
Did you volunteer then to get to go back, or were you just posted out anyway?
I was posted. I got drafted to HMS Gore.
Now, when was that?
HMS. So, actually, fact, I was in. Actually, I was longer than I thought there in. Because it's down as Mercury, because that is a signal school. I was 1st of December 43 to the 4th of February 44. So, I was about 2 months in.
Now, what were you doing in the signal school? I mean, did you have any.
No, I mean, it was. The place was overcrowded, over. Because, you know, it's sort of packed.
Was it very badly overcrowded?
It was. I mean, not, half of people didn't know what the other half were doing there. I mean, it was really overcrowded because, I mean, they, you know, sort of.
Well, the mess, well, mess tech, but, you know, the barracks, were they overcrowded?
Yeah, overcrowded, yeah. You're sleeping in hammocks in KK room and blokes on the floor and because there's people coming and going. And, I mean, I remember some of the old people who were the barrack stanchions, as they called them, had been in there and never been to sea. And the rum they had amongst them was nobody's business because the rum got out of all control because, I mean, so many people coming and going, drawing it, not drawing it, and that sort of thing. And there's obviously a few fiddles going on in there with the rum to those in the know. But, as I say, I joined the Gore 5th of February, the next day, 5th of February 44.